This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Racial tensions in Charlotte have escalated following the police shooting of an African-American man, Keith Lamont Scott, last week. Protests in the Queen City raise concerns about police treatment of minority citizens. Charlotte is an economic powerhouse in the South. It's the state's largest city, generates 30% of the state's GDP. It's home to big businesses like Bank of America. But as recent unrest demonstrates, Charlotte is a city struggling with racial and economic disparities, and those struggles often coincide with increased law enforcement presence. In Charlotte, black and Hispanic residents are roughly three times as likely to live in poverty compared to whites. And that is just one of the findings of a study earlier this year by the NC Poverty Research Fund at the UNC School of Law. And joining me now is the report's co-author, Gene Nickel, a distinguished professor of law at UNC Chapel Hill. Welcome back, Gene Nickel.
Thank you, Frank. It's nice to be here.
Also with me is Gumi Odson. He's a sociology professor at Northern Michigan University, and he published a study in 2013 that looks at the size of police departments in cities with high levels of racial and economic inequality. Gumi, welcome to the State of Things.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Gene Nickel, let me start with you and give us some of the bullet points in terms of racial and economic divisions in Charlotte.
Well, this is a very sensitive and complicated and wrenching problem, so bullet points are probably not called for, but I will do what you request, Frank. Let me just start by saying, as one who looks at poverty across North Carolina quite a bit, we traditionally think of poverty in North Carolina on a rural-urban axis, so that we know we have real challenges of poverty in much of rural North Carolina, particularly in the eastern part of the state, somewhat in the west. And then we have, on the other hand, these economic urban powerhouses, which are going like gangbusters. And that vision is true, but only as far as it goes, because what it fails to reveal is the most, when you look at it on a census tract basis or on a neighborhood basis instead of countywide or citywide, where averages can reveal or fail to reveal real challenges. The deepest poverty in North Carolina is right in the middle of Charlotte, right in the middle of Greensboro, right in the middle of Durham, right in the middle of Raleigh, right in the middle of Winston-Salem. So Charlotte is an economic powerhouse, a gem, but it has high rates of poverty. It has among the fastest increasing rates of poverty among the major cities in the United States. As you indicate, both income and poverty are very racially disproportionate or unbalanced. Maybe most troubling, one of things we concentrated most powerfully on in this report, is a growing, concentrated, racialized poverty which marks life in Charlotte. Lots and lots of poor people living together in close circumstance, which poses a real challenge for economic mobility.
Well, let me just stop you there for a second. The report showed that in 2014, for example, 70 out of 79 high-poverty tracts in Mecklenburg County were non-white.
Right, or were very highly minority. So right. what we have in Charlotte is increased concentrated poverty, larger numbers of poor people living together in sort of closer proximity, which raises a whole kind of additional set of problems. It's a double whammy of sorts. Poor people have to live with their own economic challenges, and then they have to deal with the fact that lots of people around them are dealing with theirs as well, which sort of increases the magnitude of the challenge. Now, lastly, in this report, Charlotte also struggles, like much of North Carolina does, with a kind of structural problem. Charlotte creates a lot of jobs, a lot of great jobs, a lot of high-income jobs. It also creates a whole lot of low-wage jobs, close to minimum-wage jobs. It is losing increasingly the ability to produce middle-income jobs, and that's structurally increasing this polarization, which leaves a whole lot of people out.
Well, that's, I think, one of the key findings as well. It's not just that there's a lot of poverty. It's not that it is a poor city. It is a city with high concentrations of poverty and high concentrations of wealth and not a lot in the middle.
That's right.
Well, let me talk about – you also make reference to another study a Harvard economist did when they looked at economic mobility in Charlotte. So, again, you know, one of the questions is, all right, you're poor, but we have this mobility and you can get out of poverty. And in Charlotte, it turns out that that is one of the least mobile cities in terms of getting yourself out of poverty in the state. And, in fact, the Harvard study showed in the country.
Yes, actually. And I know this has been distressing Ophelia's here, who is doing terrific work in Charlotte. This has been distressing to folks in Charlotte, but Professor Chetty's studies a couple years ago indicate that of the 50 largest cities in the United States, Charlotte has the worst economic mobility of all 50, last place, meaning that if you're born poor in Charlotte, you're more apt to stay that way than in any other major city in the country. There are a lot of reasons for that, a lot that we've looked at, and I would say, too, that that's very inconsistent with the way that Charlotte sees itself and wants to see itself. And so it has suggested a wide array of challenges.
Well, I want to take a look at the impact that this might have on policing and the way that is structured. Gumi Odson has done that at Northern Michigan University. Talk a little bit about your work for us. You looked at the size of police departments in cities with high levels of racial and economic inequality. What did you find?
So, to be more exact, we simply looked at U.S. cities with populations of over 250,000 or more, and we were doing that to predict, you know, what factors impact, so like the size of police forces. Okay, and we were of course looking at so like the relative size, so the number of sworn officers per capita in the thousands. So we're like comparing apples and apples. Okay, and so I want to, like, back up a little bit, okay? So in any society, there is need to maintain social order, okay? But how do you, like, maintain social order when there is great inequalities, you know, be it, you know, economic inequalities or racial inequalities or both, okay? And the hypotheses that we were testing, you know, derived from one school within sociology that argues that you know, dominant groups in society, you know, feel threatened, you know, by you know, by racial minorities and by the lower classes. Okay, and so we tested conflict theories, racial threat hypothesis, and the class threat hypothesis. Okay, and to just like jump to the chase. We found that cities that have two things, okay, cities that have high degrees of poverty and racial economic inequality at the same time are most likely to increase their police forces, even after factoring in things such as the prevalence of crime, population density, innovative policing, like community policing. So so this suggests, okay, and, you know, supports the claim that, you know, elites or, you know, people that have economic and political power use formal social control through the police to, you know, help subdue a population that is perceived to be rebellious.
And this is interesting because, again, it doesn't happen. We don't necessarily, you didn't find that police forces expand where there are high rates of poverty and where perhaps there is a correlation between poverty and crime. If that's true, you might think, well, if there's more crime when there's more poverty, that's when we would increase our police department. The real increase happens when there is increase, when there's poverty and disparity. That's when you see the increase.
And if you would allow me to elaborate a little bit, so we find that cities with great economic inequality between racial groups will not strengthen their police force if poverty is minimal, because less prosperous groups pose less of a threat to affluent groups if few live in poverty. However, cities with great poverty will cities with great poverty will not heighten police if economic inequality between racial groups is negligible because less prosperous groups do not threaten more successful groups, quote unquote, if the economic disparities are small and poverty is widespread. It's when we have both of these things, high levels of poverty and great economic inequality between racial groups, this is when we see police forces being expanded. It's because affluent groups feel threatened by groups who are worse off when there are both economic disparities between, the white dominant group and racial minorities, and many people live in poverty.
Well,
so it's a combination.
Well, let's see how this may be playing out in Charlotte, or may not. Joining me now is Dr. Ophelia Garman-Brown. She's the co-chair of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Opportunity Task Force, and that group aims to address racial and economic inequality in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg area. Ophelia Garman-Brown, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you for having me.
So you've heard this conversation. We're talking about poverty and disparity in Charlotte, one report that finds that, another report that finds this correlation between increased police presence when there is both poverty and racial disparity and inequality. Is this something that your task force is aware of? I mean, is this something that you've tackled frontally in your conversations?
Yes. When you look at the study that was done by Raj Chetty and the folks at Harvard and UC Berkeley that subsequently shared that out of the largest 50 metropolitan cities in the United States, Charlotte came in 50 out of 50 in upward mobility, there were five indicators that rose to the top in terms of if you have these five, then you are more likely to have a problem and you're more likely to have fewer upwardly mobile persons. And one of the five was segregation, and Charlotte is significantly segregated. It's unfortunate that persons that live in the south side of Charlotte could come to their Bank of America jobs and never see poverty because we're just that segregated. A second indicator was income inequality. And if you look at the way our map is drawn, there is resources, lots of money in the north, lots of money in the south, very little money in the west and the east. And so that's also the way the segregation is. So segregation and income inequality follow each other. But when they also, the other three that they talked about was education. Education, if your education system is not what it needs to be, and particularly in high poverty areas, upward mobility can be a challenge, and that's what we find in Charlotte. We have hyper-segregated schools in Charlotte, hyper-segregated in terms of race, but also hyper-segregated in terms of their levels of affluence or poverty. And family structure was another, single-parent homes, and lastly, social capital. If we're not in proximity, if we're not in relationship in the ways that we need to be, then we can have more of an issue. So the task force used those five as its lever in terms of how it would research these issues. And we've done a lot of research. We've had a lot of national speakers to come in. We've read a lot of books in this regard. And our city has a lot of work to do on these five indicators.
Well, if you think about Professor Otzen's research that suggests that there is a relationship between that increasing the police force, I mean, it sounds like Charlotte's response to inequality and segregation has been to beef up the police force. I mean, is this something that you can sort of pull together in your conversations and that comes up in the conversations?
Well, I think that I don't know. I cannot say that I'm familiar with the research that has been shared. I appreciate it. And I would say, though, that the size of Charlotte and the city growing the way the city is growing, that the police force has necessarily had to grow as well. It could be because of what the research has shared is the reason why that has happened. I didn't feel that as a Charlottean. I felt that we are growing by leaps and bounds in Charlotte, and in that growth, subsequently, the police department needed to grow with us.
But does it grow? I mean, I'm wondering about, again, the objectives. We heard even during the demonstrations, police talking about protecting assets. We're bringing in the National Guard to protect assets. If the focus is to protect the private property of those individuals who own it, you know, that suggests that maybe there needs to be a shift in attention in the way police are policing.
Well, I don't know that the protecting the assets was something that necessarily was about the haves and the have-nots. Because when you looked at what was happening that second day of the riots, I think the assets, wherever you were in terms of being in the path of the rioters, which I will say, as I understand it, were more people from the outside of Charlotte than actual Charlatans, that would have been a reasonable thing to do. The looting and the breaking of the windows and all of that, whether it is wherever that is happening, I think that it's reasonable that it should be protected.
What is the going forward? Where are these conversations pointing? What's the emphasis in your conversations about how things should change?
Well, we have to have a larger conversation because this isn't really about systems. This is not about an incident. It's not going to be a quick fix because when we really look at America, and I want to say that although Charlotte was 50 out of 50 and we got an F, America gets a D minus because the city that did the best was only 6 percentage points higher than Charlotte, and that was San Jose. So I think that when you really look at the United States and when we look at Charlotte, that we have to look at the fact that we are an America that has institutionalized racism. And so it's so insidious that we, even whether you're black, white, Indian, Asian, Latino, it is hard to see it because it has become the fiber of America because we're really talking about 400 years of racial inequality.
Gumi Odson, let me ask you about the research. You know, you suggest that one of the reasons, if you take a real deep look at why this policing might increase, is a sense of threat by the haves that the have-nots are coming after their stuff. How does that play itself out? Because I can't imagine the city council meeting where that open discussion was had. So how does this policy get made? And as Dr. Garman Brown suggests, sort of becomes insidious in the fabric.
Well, if we look at the forest, you know, for the trees, economic inequality and racial inequality harms societies. You know, we're talking about America getting a D minus. Well, if we look at how inequality harms societies, well, the U.S. has close to having the most wealth inequality in all the world. We're up there with, you know, Russia, okay? When we look at just like affluent democracies, the U.S. has the most income inequality. And why does this matter? Well, countries that have the most income and wealth inequality, they do worse when it comes to life expectancy, math and literacy rates, infant mortality, homicides, imprisonment, teenage births, trust, social mobility, mental illnesses, like all of these things, okay? And obviously when you have like a city like Charlotte, where I think less than 1 in 20 of people who are born to parents in the bottom 20% of the income distribution make it to the top 20%. Okay, so doesn't you know, reflect well on the so-called American dream of, you know, improving your lot and achieving upward social mobility.
Not only those markers, Gene Nickel, but also social stability. Back in the Cold War years, the CIA put out endless reports about the correlation between the wealth gap and social instability in developing countries. And now we're at the top of the list of those countries we used to look at suspiciously 40 and 50 and 60 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
You know, one of the funny things about that, the CIA still measures inequality in all the countries of the world. Looks at the Gini Index for this massive number of nations. They do it under the belief, as you just indicated, that that's a great marker for social instability. When you look at the listing that the CIA produces, the United States is nowhere around the developed world or the advanced wealthy nations. It is down among the very poorest and most unequal nations of the whole planet. So this is a massive challenge for us.
I want to thank you all. Gene Nickel, professor at UNC's Law School, Gumi Odson, sociology professor at Northern Michigan University, and Dr. Ophelia Garman-Brown, co-chair of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Opportunity Task Force. Thank you all for being on the program.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
You can find links to the research we talked about today at our website, stateofthings.org. There's more just ahead. Stay tuned.